I'm Ellen Margolis. I teach in the Department of Theater and Dance. And to my left is our special guest, visiting assistant professor,
Austin Bishop!
Austin, for those who aren't careful readers of their bio, of the bios in the program, is one-third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and we're super thrilled to have had him with us this semester.
It's been super fun.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or tablet or phone. I'm Austin Titchener, one-third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 356, discussing Much Ado. Last weekend were the opening and closing performances of my production of Much Ado About Nothing at Pacific University in Oregon. After the opening night Thursday night, Department Chair Ellen Margolis conducted a talkback conversation for the audience consisting of myself, set and light designer and head of technical theater Tal Sanders, and several of the actors. I set my production at Messina High School in the 1950s, which is sort of like Rydell High in Greece, but instead of singing about Greased lightning and beauty school dropouts, the students are speaking Elizabethan English. Ellen began the Q&A by asking about my conceptual and dramaturgical choices.
Austin, when you were looking at the script and you were looking at the script for a college production, what kind of decisions were you making in terms of cutting, setting it in a particular world? What kind of choices were front and center for you?
Well, actually, none of the choices I made had anything to do with performing it at a college. I had done a 50-minute version of Much Ado, very similar with this conception set in a 50s high school in 1989 with a group of young actors, also roughly the same age as you guys were, all of whom were going on to be professional actors. This was at a Summerstock Theater in New Hampshire, and it was a 50-minute long for an audience of mostly 5 to 9-year-olds. And I'm telling you, it's the best training in the world. Creating shows for children, because they absolutely don't care about your feelings. And if they are bored, they will start talking and playing and crying and doing whatever. They'll leave. And it worked for 50 minutes. We were able to keep that audience of children, you know, engaged and interested. And I thought, well, gee, it might work for a college audience than if it worked for 9-year-olds. So the decisions were not made with regard to performing it here. What was new and different here was that, as is always the case, there are more women than men in a college theater program, and so as we ran out of guys, I was then able to go, okay, well then who's the best actor for the part? Sort of regardless of gender. And that was really interesting as well. And so I knew coming in that Donna John would not be a male, and I knew that Dogberry would not be a male. I didn't know about Baratia, and I didn't know about Leonata. And actually, when we started rehearsals with Haley playing Baratia, we didn't know whether she'd be Baratia or Baratio, and so it just felt like, oh yeah, she's a woman. But in talking with Mel, the costume designer, we decided to costume her in such a way that there was ambiguity, and that it didn't matter. Anyway, so it's interesting. I mean, this 50 setting has a weirdly progressive sense of sexual politics, but still a side of the same kind of messed up regressive attitude towards virginity and loyalty.
So that's Melissa Heller, who's our brilliant costume designer.
Yes. Is she here?
She's not. Just a shout out to Mel, and I know Mel did some discovery about this notion of, was it the Teddy Girls?
Teddy Girls, yeah.
Which were girls that like to dress like greaser boys, kind of, in the 50s period.
Greaser boys in the 50s, but early in that, in the 20s and 30s, as sort of Edwardian dudes.
Oh, cool.
You know, so, you know, high collars. We gave her a lower collar and a choker, but other than that, and vests and whatnot.
Right.
And hats.
So can I ask you a bonus question?
Yes.
Based on what you were saying about sort of, you know, making your way with Haley and deciding what that character was. What discoveries did you make about the play this time, revisiting it?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. That there's a lot going on. That there's really, I mean, I think every time I see it, I mean, every rehearsal and every performance I see, I discover new things, even in this cut-down script. I also, we discovered in rehearsal that the text supports many of the directorial choices, which I am really grateful for. I mean, it really seems to work, Aragon College and just the treatment of Claudio as this person who puts Hero up on this pedestal and treats her like a god is actually supported in the text when he says, "I see her as Diane." And also the casting of Phoebe as Hero, the first decision I did casting Phoebe as Hero gave that character agency in a way that is rarely seen in that role. Gave her strength and at the end, I mean, this is the thing.
And intelligence,
and it's clear who's wearing the pants in their relationship, and that's great. And sometimes you come out of this play, at the end of this play, you go, oh, okay, Beatrice Benedict, that's great. Hero and Claudio, oh, God, I don't know what that's going to be about. But I think in this play, you kind of go, well, Beatrice and Benedict, they'll make it work. Claudio's not long for this world, and Hero's going to be just fine.
Hal, can we hear from you a little bit about this kind of marriage of this 50s and high school look with, I think, some of the vocabulary of a classic Elizabethan set?
It was definitely always in my mind that we wanted to do something that was more akin to a traditional Shakespeare and almost like an inner above, as much as we can achieve in the space. And that we had this notion of the opening of the play, as you saw, that it would feel a little bit like it was going to be stodgy, normal Shakespeare, and we played the Elizabethan music beforehand and all that, and then really kind of rip the curtain and turn it around. And what the play actually, I think, requires scenically is places where people can be near a conversation and overhear it from the shadows, right? That's really what Shakespeare seems to be asking for. So the arches sort of suggested school and gave us lots of places for people to sneak into scenes. And then as we started talking about the 50s idea of it and really sort of breaking that tradition by bringing in very different objects that would anchor each scene, the arches served as a fantastic sort of set of garage doors to be able to get stuff on and off stage quickly. So that was kind of the impetus for it. But, you know, we've played a couple times. We did Romeo and Juliet a few years ago, and we played with the idea of a balcony in the space, which I think works pretty well. And so it was fun to revisit that and try to shape something around that idea out here on the apron and make more of this apron, which is a great playing space for performers here so close to the audience. And so it gave us an opportunity to draw some of that down, though I will say, and the actors will attest to, the entrances on and off stage here are difficult as they have to duck over a low wall to get off stage here. But it was fun to use it just the same. So does that answer your question?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
What questions do you have for any of us?
Yeah. A little bit of both. Did I have to give the actors direction about their characters, or did they kind of come up with it their own? I mean, I think it was a collaboration.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a bunch of ideas, and you know, and so for the first couple of weeks, I had to go, oh, goodbye, some ideas, because they weren't going to work, because I had images in my head of because I had done it 30 years ago, right? So I had to let those ideas go, which was fine, because almost in every case, we came up with better ideas. And it was fun because it felt like, so what was this, a six-week rehearsal process? In the middle of the third week, it sort of began to click with the actors and maybe with me too, as I begin to figure out how to talk to these guys, because each actor requires a different vocabulary, right? Everybody learns in a different way. Everybody processes information in a different way. And I'm not 100% sure I completely solved it, but or figured out how to talk to every actor individually, but that's what a director has to do. You know, whenever I see a bad performance on stage, I rarely blame the actor, because it's either the actor is miscast, playing a role he or she shouldn't play, maybe, or that the director failed in some way to communicate to the actor what was necessary. So I think we did it tonight, though. And so collaboration is the short answer, the reduced answer, which I didn't give. Sorry.
You gave it right there. After the
long there it is. After the long one.
You can edit that part out.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Ken Ludwig, a playwright and author of Lend Me a Tenor, Crazy for You, Baskerville, and the new book, How to Teach Your Children Shakespeare, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSE? In the next few weeks, the RSE UK is performing William Shakespeare's long-lost first play Abridged at the Buxton Opera House, the Waterside Arts Centre at Sale, the King's Theatre in Glasgow, the Brewery Arts Centre in Kendal, and the Forum in Barrow-in-Furness. And then next week, we'll see the London premiere of William Shakespeare's long-lost first play Abridged with five performances at Wilton's Music Hall. And in the U.S. this week, we'll be performing Friday night at the Kirby Center for the Creative Arts in Kingston, Pennsylvania, and on Sunday the 26th at the Marathon Center in Findlay, Ohio. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office, venue, and ticket information. And now back to the Pacific University talkback discussion following the opening night performance of my production of Much Ado About Nothing. A student in the audience had read both Shakespeare's original and my adaptation and wondered how we were able to find the funny. Phoebe Whittington, who played Hero, was the first to answer, as she was followed by Josh Hauser, who played Benedict, and Elise Dixon, who played Beatrice.
It's very different to read Shakespeare and to see it and perform it. And so it's sort of a marriage of the two. I know that for me, if there was ever something I didn't understand about a line of mine, I would just do it with a lot of conviction and loudly and hope that, that worked. And that actually ended up, like, once I heard something like that, either from myself or from the rest of the cast, that usually helped solidify its place and its circumstances and what it actually meant. But a lot of it is just kind of between the lines acting and on the lines acting, so it would, you know, obviously there were a lot of times where I had to go, what does this mean? I have no idea what this is. But for the most part, it was just a fairly steady trek of discovery of like, oh, that's working, okay. So just sort of both for me.
Trial and error, yeah.
Like, I would say it's the main part about this whole process is that all of these characters are not real. Like, not just like their characters, but all of their decisions are stupid. Like,
well, they're high schoolers.
Fair. Yeah. But that helps, because the point is that, like, everything is being felt 150,000%. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, everything that Claudio's dealing with is, like, turn on a dime because one small thing happened. So you're dealing with these huge emotional states, and that's the funny, is the fact that we're dealing with love and pain and everything, but it's also cranked up to, like, 19. Mm-hmm. And so those scenes that have, like, the, guys, like, it's exciting because you can see how much the characters are over-feeling everything, and when you read that, it's like, wow, Claudio, you're just a dick. So, like, I think ramping it up of emotion really assists with all of that humor.
Yeah, well, at auditions...
And it only took them 3 or 4 weeks to get there.
Well, at auditions, Austin told us that a lot of great comedy comes from people taking really stupid things really, really seriously, which is exactly what Josh was saying, I think, about the stakes just being so high. And then we throw in a lot of physical comedy in this, like we have the lockers and the bathroom. Everything's funnier with toilets in it.
So, Write that down.
So, you know, you have these heightened emotions, the people taking, you know, their high school crushes so seriously. This high school crush is life or death, and they're in a locker, and they're standing on a toilet. So it just, there's a lot of the comedy is there. It's in the script. It's in the witticisms of Shakespeare's text and in the circumstances of Shakespeare's text with them taking things so seriously. But then it's also, we added in a lot of physical comedy, I think.
Well, it's also just hearing it out loud. I mean, just even we were rehearsing it without an audience, and now to have a lovely audience tonight, you hear Shakespeare's lines getting laughs with no spin, with just good actors reading a text intelligently, and you go, oh, right, that guy was pretty good.
Just to follow up, sometimes audiences teach you what's funny, too. And if you're smart, you remember that in the next night. It's, you know, a designer comes in to watch a run through where some, you know, somebody comes in. I was coming in to listen to prediction things, and I was laughing. And then these guys were going, that's funny. We'll do that again.
Other questions? Other, yeah, you're right here.
I'm curious about the band.
Yeah. Weren't they awesome? How about a hand for the Revelers? For sure. It came from that production 30 years ago. I have a composer partner. We write musicals together. We were in the BMI Music Theater workshop. And I said I was doing this, and could you set Sigh No More to a 50s beat? And he went, oh, yeah, rockabilly, like the next day, here. You know? And I've used it a bunch. I've used that tune a bunch. It's in the Reduced Shakespeare radio show, which is on iTunes, available on iTunes. I use that same melody. Richard III sings it on a ukulele in William Shakespeare's long lost first play, Abridged. And now the Revelers are playing, but this was the great miracle and discovery was at the first table read. We sat there around the table, and I said, who plays instruments? I might have asked that at the auditions, too, but I had forgotten by that point. But said, well, I play bass tonight. And then a bunch of people said, no, Haley and Sid said, I play guitar. And Garrett said, I'm a percussionist, and this is what I do. And I said, well, can you just play like a snare? And he went, oh, okay. And I knew from the auditions that Trevor could sing. So that's how the band came together, and it's so awesome. I still want to write a full-on musical version of this where the Revelers play all the songs.
You want to email me with that casting call?
Yes, I will. I will. Same. All right. Cool. Yeah. How did you bring Elizabethan language into 50s vernacular?
Well, it was really interesting because I know when I first started doing some Shakespeare stuff in high school, it was always very, ho-ho, now I am saying this to the audience. Ah, now I am acting. Ah, tragedy, comedy, ha-ha. But when we were doing this, some of us kept trying to do that, and Austin was like, no, say it like you're just talking normally, but with these words. So it was a lot of kind of breaking that old, like, Shakespeare sound, but still using those lines and just saying them like I'm just talking to you now, just saying them like a normal human being that's not on stage to each other.
Yeah, absolutely, because you're dealing with, like, imagine just casually talking and throwing in doth every once in a while. That's basically the direction that we were given, was that if we were doing something too stagey, he literally was like, okay, now just talk to each other as, like, cover what the material you need to, but just do it casually, just say it. And so Lisa and I had some great scenes of just like, you're stupid. No, you're dumb. You're saying the same things I'm saying, ha.
Well, don't talk to me. I'm funnier than you, and I don't want to talk to you, and you're stupid, and I hate you.
Yeah, and once you get that style of talking, and you plug it in with Elizabethan style, that's how we bridge that gap, which is so weird. Mm-hmm. Like, it was weird for us to be like, okay, yo, what's up, my lord? You know?
Well, and that was one thing that I found really helped, actually, was we decided that my lord meant dude. So you go, well, yeah, my lord. And it makes it so much easier because that also helps with the transition from, you know, in the original text, Don Pedro is the prince. You know, Leonata is the master of this household. And so there's a class thing going on. And so there's my lord, there's the prince, there's sir. And it's there in the language, and so having my lord be more casual, be dude, helped bridge that divide in the text.
Yeah. I think the one thing that I think applies across the board, just with theater in general and not just to Shakespeare, is just you have to be able to access the universal humanity of your characters, no matter the period piece or the language. And so it's just tapping into that, like, base, yes, these are human characters, that pretty much solves a lot of issues that you have with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, write that down.
And also, from Shakespeare and before Shakespeare and after Shakespeare, there are always archetypes of characters that are in every single piece of media that you've seen or any single piece of fiction. And so those are things that are recognizable to an audience. Even if they don't get a few grammatical things, they understand what you're trying to say if you're acting it. And so if they miss like a few like small two-letter words, they'll still understand the entire thing.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. That was Jenna Cady, you just heard, who played Donna John, and also earlier Matt Goss, who played Claudio. Send us your Shakespearean conceptions via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also engage with us and other fans on Facebook or Twitter. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. You can also follow me on Twitter @AustinTichner. Thanks, as always, to Hobby Horse Matthew Croak, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and Garage Band. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Megan Chapman. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Ken Ludwig, author of Lend Me a Tenor and How to Teach Your Children Shakespeare. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 536 1608ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. And now I'll leave you with a performance by The Revelers, singing Sigh No More, words by William Shakespeare, music by Andrew Kline, lead vocal Trevor Harder, with Garrett Brown on drums, Brennan Staffieri on bass, Haley McKinnon on rhythm guitar, and Siddharth Raj on lead guitar. They're going to party like it's 1959. Enjoy.
Hey, everybody, we're the Revelers. Woo! Sigh no more, ladies, sigh no more. Men were deceivers ever. One foot on sea and one on shore. To one thing constant ever. So sang out so.
Is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.